Empower Radio presents The Farkas Files, an exploration of energy, metaphysics, and the paranormal with David Franklin Farkas. The Farkas Files. The truth is in here, somewhere. Here's your host, David Franklin Farkas.
Good evening. Thanks so much for being with us. I hope you had wonderful holidays. We took a little break, as you probably noticed, since we figured the holidays were on Thursday nights and people would be distracted and involved with their family and the holiday events. So this is our first live show in the year 2015. So happy new year. And we have a wonderful guest tonight, Steve Nickerson has an amazing story, and we will be talking to him in just a few minutes. But first, tonight's metaphysical musing. And, you know, when you talk about the weather, people figure you're doing small talk. But a lot of what conversations I've had lately have been about the weather. You know, why? Well, Christmas Day, where I live in New England, it was 55 degrees and raining. That's a mind bender. It's not supposed to be doing that in this supposedly cold place. So that was the topic of conversation for a couple of weeks. And then we just had a huge switch in the weather. And last night we had our first deep chill. So all of my online conversations were about how cold is it where you are. And before I went to bed, it was several degrees below zero with wind chills down around 10 below zero or lower. And it's the first time in this new apartment, in a house in the middle of nowhere, where the wind comes whipping through the property. It was the first time I experienced how the house behaves in that weather. But it's fascinating to me how much of our conversation has to do with that stuff. And part of the reason for that, obviously, is it affects everything that we do. And there's an old, I found out it's a Norwegian saying, that there is no bad weather, there's just poor clothing choices. Which is true up to a point. And then my little saying kicks in, which is, I don't like weather that hurts. I don't care if it's really, really hot and it hurts my skin, or it's really, really cold and windy and it hurts my skin. If the weather hurts, I'm pretty much not going to go out. And I have the option to do that since I work from home. You know, go watch the weather report, buy my food, and run my errands on the days when it's not wicked cold, and stay in when it is. But part of the reason for that is kind of a been there, done that feeling. You know, I was a lifeguard for several years, and I've spent an entire weekend out in 108 degree heat, which through a sweatshirt turned my skin purple. It's not fun. I've done it. I can say I did it, been there, done that. I've gone winters snowshoeing in the winter, solo climbing because it's really beautiful and quiet and wonderful, but it's kind of a stupid thing to do. But I was young and stupid, so I did it because it was a fun thing to do. But I don't need to prove to myself anymore that I can do that stuff. I've done it. I have the gear. If I need to go out in the cold or go out in the sun, I know how to do that without getting hurt. I'm prepared for it. But I choose not to challenge myself in those ways because I've got nothing to prove to myself anymore about that anyway. And I wonder, you know, when you're young, you're always proving yourself to yourself and to the people that you want to impress and show that you're growing up and you're competent and you know what you're doing and they can trust you. But at some point, you can really shift your focus from I'm going to demonstrate that I can do this to, okay, I've done that, and now what's really important in life? Is that how I want to distract myself? Is that what I want to go out and do? Maybe it's fun. Maybe you want to do it just because it's fun. And you have friends that do it. But for a lot of people, there is a real angst behind it that you have to show that you can. And one of my teachers said, how many times do you have to have an experience before you know that it's real? Which was talking about more esoteric things. But how many times do you have to do something before you feel like, okay, I've done that. Now I'm going to move on to doing new things. And so here we are at the beginning of a new year, which is a totally artificial construct, especially the solar calendar, which really has to get fussed with to be accurate. All we need to know is the cycles of the moon. That's really the important part of the year. And the old traditions and the old religions were all based on lunar calendars. But here we are at the beginning of a new year in the solar calendar, the one that everybody has been using in the Western world for a long time. And we have a tradition of saying goodbye to the old and starting new things. So my question to you is, if you were going to accept all the things that you have done, been there, done that, got the t-shirt, wore it out, used it for a painting rag, and threw it away, now what? What's the next thing? What's the next thing that you deeply want to know about, you deeply want to learn about, you want to experience, you want to give? What's next? Because that's my question. And that's, in many ways, the only question. What next? What shall I do now? So I leave you with that for the metaphysical musing. And now we're going to have fun with my guest, Steve Nickerson, who has an incredible story that I think sounds just like that. How are you doing tonight, Stephen?
Oh, thanks. I'm glad to be here.
And you're joining us from your home in Venezuela.
Right. Yes.
Which sounds very exotic from here.
Yeah. It's exotic. It's crazy making. it's thrilling. It's scary. All of that, but the weather's fine. I mean, it rarely gets below 65 and it never gets above 85. And there's always a nice wind coming through. We live in the highlands above the Caribbean and Southern Caribbean, and the trade winds just always come through and make whatever is there friendly.
Yeah. Well, it sounds absolutely delightful. Don't rub it in too much.
It's not always delightful. Sometimes.
Right. But I may be asking you about places to move to after my daughter's out of college.
Don't come here. There's the highest inflation rate and the highest murder rate of any place in the Western Hemisphere.
Wow. Well, that's a whole other story.
Let's not go into it.
Let's not go too far down that one. But no. When I asked you for your bio, and I know that we're going to talk about some of the amazing spiritual experiences you've had and all the things that you've both gone through and done. But you gave a list of jobs. My joke has always been, I've had a lot of jobs, and the odd jobs were really odd. And your list beats mine. So I hope as you tell your story, because I know there's a lot that you want to share, that you include some of the wild and crazy things you've been able to do.
Right. Well, they all tie together because
I'm sure.
It's a whole life. It's a whole life.
Yeah.
And you can't separate one thing out from the other. It's a process. It's a river. It's a crazy river.
So where would you like to start the story?
Excuse me. I need to make a kind of caveat here. A kind of context. I spent 33 years as an investigator in one way or another, and I've interviewed a lot of people, a lot of people. And I found that if I didn't get a context in there, like how are they hardwired, mm-hmm. where, you know, then whatever they said above that might not make sense.
Right.
And so, for example, I've been watching, you know, I've been listening to your interviews and studying your habits and so on, David. And there's a trend in the people that you interview that they're kind of ethereal and healers and live a decent life and privilege the spiritual. And I seem to be an anomaly, and this is hardwired. You know, if I'm going to privilege anything, it's good food and good drink and sweet loving and cheap thrills, of which there are plenty in Venezuela if you get out on the highway. And a good, you know, hit of adrenaline every time the opportunity comes along. And, you know, if you're going to Jungian Myers-Briggs stuff, and Kiersey, Dr. Kiersey is somebody mm-hmm. in that racket. I test out as a very extroverted sensory type human being, and most of people that I have listened to on your show, I would guess 95% of them are introverted intuitives. And whatever that has to do with it. But anyway, I'm the anomaly. And so I hope that as we go along, that will provide a background to what I say might make a little more sense.
Okay.
We talked a little beforehand about some stuff that might not fit very well into the regular flow of what we've planned here. And two instances that have changed my life. And I don't know what, I can't remember which came first. I'll say, let's go at this. I was driving down the road one time outside of Laramie, Wyoming, where I was going to school. And I was thinking about an essay George Orwell wrote called about the English language, politics in the English language. And he quoted a passage in there from Ecclesiastes that in the old days, in the old King James Version of the Bible, read that I returned and I saw everything under the sun was vanity.
Mm.
And that struck me And I'm, you know, I'm not a Christian, but that struck me. And I thought, well, Kohelet, who supposedly wrote Ecclesiastes, saw my vanity also. And when I was 24 years old, there was plenty of it, you know. I was living high and wide, and I saw that everything I had thought and held dear and so on was part of that vanity.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, I realized my total insignificance, my absolute total insignificance in the scope of everything from the top to the bottom, from the bottom to the top. And some people find that very depressing. And I found that just amazingly liberating. I went into an ecstatic trance. In those days, I went into a lot of ecstatic trances because that's what I was living for. And you cannot imagine the depth of the feeling of liberation of that. And the vision opened up. And I guess this is shamanic. And I was driving down the highway. And in my mind's eye, the vision opened up. And I was in an ecstatic trance of the abyss of where I would be totally insignificant. And I dove in, you know, and I'm still in the abyss. It's a free fall through the abyss. And it's wonderful. And if everything is vanity, then nothing has meaning. And that's true. And the point is that your soul has to give it meaning. You have to create that. And it doesn't matter if it has meaning to anyone else or not. Your meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And it might not last past, you know, the last breath you take. But it's what holds you together through the free fall in the abyss. And, you know, and I don't know if I'll ever hit bottom. And I like to think, Diogenes was a cynic. And that means dog-like. And mm-hmm. I've forgotten the Greek word for cat-like, but that's what I would be. That anything that a human being does that a cat would not do is folly. And if you watch cats, they do a lot. They do a lot, and it's all sensible, and it all comes out of instinct and experience. And that's sort of where life in the abyss comes from. And, if the bottom comes, if it ever comes, I expect to land on my feet. Anyway. The second thing that changed my life was I was a test subject in a dream experiment in a dream lab at the university there that had a highly reputable dream lab, sleep lab. And the guy who was running the experiment, it was a PhD study. And he was looking for dreams that came out of the deepest, deepest part of sleep, that which the Buddhists call deep, dreamless sleep. And they're hard to find. I mean, this guy tested so many subjects and he had so few dreams that he, you know, it was give and take whether his, you know, PhD work had statistical significance. Mm-hmm. Anyway, they buzzed me awake one night. And the first thing I knew, I was in this almost paralytic, ecstatic trance. And there floating in front of me was what I came to learn was the alchemist's stone. And I realized in an instant that stone, in its wholeness, contained every thought, every emotion, every concept that had ever been produced on this earth. That it was total consciousness, that it resolved all contradictions. It was perfect omniscience. And I was looking at it. And then I realized it was coming out of my mind. Mm-hmm. That changed my life. I was a hardcore left wing, new left radical up to that point. And then I saw, no, you can't do that when you know this stuff. You can't be that way. When you've seen that. Anyway, so that's more context. That's more context. A few sleep nights later, I saw this incredible ocean-going tug that was cast out of solid blue plastic, sky blue plastic, which is pretty strange. That it was the same omniscience there. And that was a little more personal. But it confirmed the first part was not just an hallucination. It was real. So anyway, that's context. I'm going to go back. And I'm not wild about talking about shamanic experiences. I like non-ordinary reality is the word. And my first experience with that was when I was 11 years old.
Uh-huh.
And we had a ranch in the foothills of the Wind River Mountains, central Wyoming. And a river ran through it. And it was one of these, you know, a mountain river. And on either side of it, there was brush and tangled and juniper trees and rocks and stuff. And I lived out there. I lived in that stuff. And there was this guy who was a friend of the family had asked us if he could set a trap line up through there. He wanted to trap mink, which I know isn't politically correct these days, but this was 1955. So, and I wanted to see what it was about. And so, I came home from school. It was January. There was a drought. There was no snow on the ground. The ground was frozen solid. And I saw his truck in the driveway. And I ran in the house and asked my mother where he was, and she said, he's up the river. And so I took out after him. And it was almost dark. And there was no tracks. How am I going to find this guy in these woods?
We're going to have to leave. We're going to have to come back with that question because we need to go to.
Okay.
I hate to Good interrupt
enough.
You.
That's fine.
My guest is Stephen Nickerson. We will be back in just a few minutes, or as I usually say, we'll be back shortly unless I get taller. Here on the Farkas Files on Empower Radio. Don't go nowhere.
Styling your hair every day, and do you want a good hairstyle every day? Hi, I'm Sarah Schuster. I went on a website called InventNow.org, and after that, I decided to invent something too. Something called the InstaDo. Just imagine, you just put it over your head like a helmet does, and you pick your hairstyle with the buttons on the side. Then you can have instant hairstyle in seconds. People like it. People like Jeff Bart.
I like it.
And people like Kenneth.
It's this helmet thing, and it fits over your head, and it's great.
Thank you, Kenneth. You should go to inventnow.org, and it could help you come up with your own invention. After all, look at me on the radio now.
Anything's possible. Keep thinking. Get started on your own inventions, or just play some games at inventnow.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, the National Inventors Hall of Fame Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Come to the forest. It's a place not so far away. A place where you don't have to mow the lawn or babysit.
I saw lizards and squirrels and bugs.
Ladybugs, caterpillars. It's really cool, actually.
A place where you don't have to make time for free time.
Lots and lots of kinds of species here.
Out here, you may even meet the mysterious creature known as the other you. The enchanted you.
It's magic what flowers do.
The adventurous you.
My favorite tree, yes, that one.
The free-to-be-me you. Ask your parents to take you to this not-so-far-away place. Come to the forest, where the other you lives. But first, stop by discovertheforest.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Have you ever lost a cat? And have you ever wanted to get your cat back after you lost it? Hi there, I'm Andrew Hoffman. I went on this website called InventNow.org. Then I decided to make an invention of my own. It's called the Lost Cat Magnet Invention. So you can get your cat back after you lost it. Just turn it on and lost cats stick to it. That's a good cat. If your cat was hiding up in a tree, it won't be up a tree anymore. It will be stuck to the lost cat magnet. And sometimes they fly toward you in the air. Just listen to one satisfied cat. See, that's proof. You should go to the InventNow.org website too. But just remember one thing. Don't do a lost cat magnet.
Anything's possible. Keep thinking. Get started on your own inventions or just play some games at InventNow.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, the National Inventors Hall of Fame Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Now back to the Farkas Files with David Franklin Farkas on Empower Radio.
And we're back with my guest, Stephen Nickerson, who's joining us from Venezuela and was just in the middle of a story, and I'm on the edge of my seat wanting to know what happened when you were 11.
Well, I was dashing up through these trees and the thickets and the willows and the junipers and so on, and it was getting dark, and I knew that he wasn't going to be on the trail. There was a trail there because he was setting traps along the river. And suddenly I saw this footprint on a rock. And I thought, you can't do that. Can't do that. But there was this footprint on a rock. And I looked, and I looked on the other rocks, and there wasn't anything. And I looked back, and the footprint was gone. And I looked around on other rocks, and there was a footprint ahead of me a little ways on a rock. And then I looked ahead of me a little ways, and I saw that there were trees, branches of willows and junipers. They were glowing. And so, you know, on careful inspection, they weren't glowing. But up ahead a ways, they were glowing.
Right.
And then I realized that when I was in that area of the glow, the air felt one way, that there was a sweet kind of thickness to it. It was a little more dense than the air that was ambient when I was off the trail. And I just followed that. I followed those signs. And I found him. And when I came upon him, he just finished his work. Or he was finishing his work. And he said, "How did you find me?" And I said, "I followed your trail." And he said, "I didn't leave a trail." And I told him where he had set two other traps downstream. And he said, "You had better eyes than I do." And he made me a partner in his trap line right then and there.
Mm.
We were partners for 2 years. And that taught me how to hunt. And I never talked to people about it because I thought that if it came easy to me, then other people would know about it.
Right.
But apparently they don't. And I would help find, you know, elk for other people, and very rarely I would hunt myself, and in various ways and variations on that theme, I learned about predator magic, and I learned about prey magic, and I could tell when something was following me out there. There's this feeling that sort of comes down from the sky, like a baptism that comes onto your head and goes down the back of your skull and down your spine, and it's not a good feeling at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it means that something back there has you in its sights or in its eyesight. And it's good to pay attention to that and look around, and because if you don't and a coyote howls from 25 yards behind you, it turns your blood to ice.
Right. Right.
So, you know, I learned about that stuff and I took it into professional application as an investigator.
Yeah, well, as soon as you were unfolding all of this, I was saying, "Oh, I see where this went with the being an investigator, and must have been one hell of an investigator."
I did all right. I did all right. I would come up to somebody and hand them their, you know, people would pay me to track down folks at, you know, the regular, say, process servers couldn't find.
Right.
And in a couple of weeks, I would know where they were. And some of it was just, you know, regular, cop stuff. Though I wasn't a cop and never wanted to be a cop. And I didn't do cop stuff. I did criminal defense work mostly, and missing people and that kind of thing. And they'd say, how in the hell did you find me? I said, I'm just looking. And I think one of the best things is at one time in a civil action, the plaintiffs in this case needed to find a gypsy truck driver who had a 3.5 year head start. And I was within less than a month, I was within a week of him. And then we found out he had a partner who had a big insurance policy. And so forget that guy. We have the deep pocket. Who cares about the gypsy truck driver? But here's an interesting thing. Finding people. And finding people who have evidence. Finding people that need to come into court and tell their story and things like that. There was, I might as well bring this in here now. It might take a little background. A tiny bit of background is that one time in something I might go into later, though I'm not comfortable about going into right now, is I had a near-death experience.
Mm.
And it wasn't, it was an anomalous near-death experience as far as near-death experiences go. And I found myself on this beautiful boulevard, New York City. And there was this tower, high building. And outside of the building was this little man who sort of looked like the detective in the movie about Roger Rabbit. And he ushered me into the building. This incredible building of stainless steel and glass and exquisite rock work. And he said, I want to introduce you to the head gravedigger. And I realized that this was the National Cemetery Administration, mm-hmm. which there isn't one, in daylight reality. But this right. was near-death reality. And he said, listen, we were walking down the hall, and he said, listen, this is him now on the public address system. And this voice came on. He was being interviewed about his job, and it was soft and sweet. It was almost effeminate. And he was talking about how he so cared for every single fallen veteran, every single man who had died in combat, that he would personally visit their graves at least once every 20 years to make sure that it was tended correctly, to make sure that that dead man was honored. And I was not impressed. He sounded, it didn't sound like a head grave digger to me. And then the little man said to me, look, here he comes down the hall. And here he came down the hall. He was huge, dark man, shaved head. And I realized that he was the most dangerous man in the world. He was the Lord of Death. Mm-hmm. And I was introduced. And he was honorable more than he needed to be honorable. He was courteous more than he needed to be courteous. He was, he was a perfect gentleman who would, when your time was up, kill you. And without feeling, without anything, that was his job, Lord of Death. And he, ushered, and he said, we have something we want to show you. And so he ushered me, bowed me into an elevator, and I stepped into the elevator, and suddenly the left-hand wall of this elevator turned into a stainless steel tsunami and came rolling down upon me. And I leaped for the back of the elevator, and it just brushed past my coat. And I turned around to see how the little man and the Lord of Death had fared. And they were looking, they were still standing in the door of the elevator, watching how I handled it with a grin on their face. And they nodded, okay, you've passed your first test. And we went to the top of this building onto an observation deck. And I looked out. And there, what they wanted me to see was a Statue of Liberty. Not with the torch above her head, but with her torch held out in front of her like a guide. Like a guide, not as a beacon, but as a way forward. And she was huge. She was incredibly huge. Far bigger than the Statue of Liberty in New York. And there were these men, these soldiers, taking care of her. You know, they were washing her and polishing her. And every time they had the chance with their high-pressure hoses, they would try and knock each other off the building and so on. And there were guys rappelling off the building, bouncing off the observation deck. Like they were, you know, they were maniacs. All of these soldiers. And then there was this announcement came over the PA system again that said, you know, watch to the skies. It's dangerous, dangerous. Find shelter. Right above us is a pending mid-air collision. There's a fighter jet and a single prop private plane on a collision course, and it's too late to avoid a total collision. They're both going to die. And I looked up, and that fighter pilot, he turned that fighter inside out to fall away from the collision. I mean, he did the impossible. So no one was going to die that day. And then the little man and the Lord of Death, and I realized by this time that where I was Valhalla, the hall of the battle dead in Nordic myth. Mm-hmm. And the Lord of Death was one of the aspects of Odin. And that, you know, that's kind of in my line of work. I read runes, Nordic runes, you know. I'm 6'3", and I once had blonde hair down to the middle of my back, and now it's all gray. But they came back for me, and they said, okay, you know, you've seen what you need to see. We go down to, we open the elevator door, you know, the stainless steel tsunami rolls past. We look at each other and grin, and we go down to the bottom floor. And the Lord of Death said, I'm glad that you could come. I'm glad that you have been here. You can come back anytime you want. You're free to come and go. Now, how's our time? This might be.
We have about 10 minutes.
Oh, yeah. Okay. We're cool. A number of years ago, based on friendships and so on, and connections, I was hired to investigate the death of a Native American man who had died under unusual circumstances, and his friends and family were not particularly pleased with them, with the regular investigation into it. So they hired me to search deeper. And so I went to the place where his body was discovered, and I turned predator, and I started just feeling the energy. And sometimes I work with a pendulum, and I couldn't find anything. There was nothing there, absolutely nothing, no energy. And in a couple of days, I found out, you know, because I thought that there would be, you know, I could follow that energy. But there wasn't any there to follow. And in a few days, I found out that the Native American priests on his reservation in a different state had lost track of him, too. Mm. And they, you know, we were all trying to find him on the other side, which sometimes isn't hard. But in this case, it was hard. It was impossible. And I went along and did, you know, the regular routine footwork. And I had a dream that I saw him on the edge of a lake wrapped in a blanket. I called someone over, and when they got there, he was gone. Mm-hmm. And one night, I had this dream. I was walking up through that same riverbed, you know, where I had been when I was 11, more or less. You know, it was that kind of countryside, that kind of hard country. And this guy came down a slope, rocky ridge, and my direction. And and we had this sense that we knew each other. And he said, "Well, give me the name of a mutual friend." So I did. And he said, "Oh, right, I know you." And I said, "I know you." And he told me about his life standing there. I wondered if he wasn't a little hungover because he'd just woken up. And what was he doing up there in that, you know, there in the woods, if he was just waking up? And he told me where he was living. He told me the name of the woman he lived with. He told me the name of their landlord, and how he was living this really fine life, peaceful, good life. And then we parted, and feeling good about having made that encounter. And I woke up, and as I was waking up, his face. He was a red-headed guy with a lot of freckles when I knew him in high school. And that's where I knew him. And I woke up, and that face was like etched on the back of my eyelids. And I realized that he was a guy who was one of the first young men from Wyoming who was killed in the Vietnam War. And so I made a note of that in my journal. And a few weeks later, his name was Norman. And a few weeks later, I was on a dream, you know, finishing up a dream, and the dream was over, and I was still there. And I was wondering why I was still there. And this guy stepped out of the, you know, the wing, so to speak, and part of the dream set. And he said, "You're Stephen?" I said, "Yeah." And he said, "I have a message for you from Norman." And he said, "He's been up in Taos County. It's where the man died." And he said, he's been working 24/7 trying to find that man. Of course, he was trying to find that man in the spirit reality.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, it can't be done. That man has gone so far away that you'll never find him. And so I said, thank you. And he said, Norman wants to know if he can go home now. He has things to take care of back there. Mm. And I said, yeah, tell Norman he can go and tell him thanks a lot. And, you know, that's, you know, how you find people if you need to. I mean, this is Pathfinder stuff. You know,
well, yeah, you know,
old Taoist said that if you can employ ghosts, hey, you're doing all right.
Well, you know, you're making light of the profound skills and abilities that you've got that most people don't have. Mm. And, you know, you don't use the word shaman and you use non-ordinary reality, and it doesn't really matter what you call it, psychic, right, shaman, whatever it is, right, but you're using dream work, you're using reading the energy, you're dowsing, you're talking to the spirit realm. Yeah, I get it.
I find life easier to take if it's not serious, and maybe I'm making.
I was just talking to one of my friends that also does this kind of work, who's been my best friend since the first day of high school, which is a ridiculously long time, and he was saying something about one of the magic traditions and how funny something was, and I just looked at him. We're on the phone. I said, well, you know, if you don't take this stuff with a grain of salt and a lot of laughter, you go completely crazy. And he said, absolutely right. You can't take this stuff too seriously because you can't make complete sense out of it.
Right. You can't. I knew this woman back there, and she lived on a mountain by herself and outside in somewhere in Wyoming. And she had all these little shrines set up out in this, you know, in the forest in this mountain. And all these little shrines were the place where the local spirits dwelt.
Mm-hmm.
And she knew them all.
And probably tended the shrines.
And she tended the shrines. She created the shrines. And and every, at some time, maybe Halloween, maybe not, she would take the kids from the city below the mountain on a little tour of the shrines and talk about, you know, this spirit and that spirit and this elf and some other fairy, and they all live there.
Oh, if we get to talking about little people, we can, that's a whole other hour.
Yeah, but the thing was, I asked her one time about this. And she said, if you talk about this stuff as if you talk about normal reality, if I talk about an elf, as my conversation with an elf, as if I am talking about my conversation with my next door neighbor over the backyard fence, and it's real.
Right.
But if you get all awestruck with it and all dewy-eyed and awestruck, then it's not real. Then it's right. Not real.
Stephen, clearly we're going to talk a lot more, and we're going to have you back, but we're out of time.
I notice that.
So I want to thank you so much for being on the show, and I hope you will come back and share more of your stories with us. My guest tonight is Stephen Nickerson. You can find him on Facebook. The link is on the Facebook event and on my blog. Thank you so much for being on the show, Stephen.
It's been great.
It's been a total pleasure. Stay on after we wrap things up. We can chat a little bit more.
Good.
This has been a wonderful conversation with Stephen Nickerson, who is joining us from his home in Venezuela, here on the Farkas Files. And if by chance you're curious about what I do, you can go to househealing.com. And Cleverly Hiding in Plain View on the contact tab is every conceivable technology for getting in touch with me, including a link to my scheduling calendar. I do a 20-minute free assessment of whatever's going on with the person, place, situation, whatever it may be, to see if my work might be helpful to you. So please take advantage of that. If you want more information about the show, go to thefarkasfiles.com. And you will find the basic information and also the archive of all the shows going back however many years we've been doing this. We're coming up, I think, on 4 years. Lots of interesting people, lots of fascinating stories. Thank you so much for being with us. Happy New Year again. And we will talk to you next week. Have a fantastic time. This is David Franklin Farkas. For the Farkas Files, the truth is in here somewhere.